and Russell perked up.
So what do you need?
A CAG, the captain replied. One able to go on a mission without leaving someone else in the lurch. A black mission. One that will never officially have happened.
How'd you get tied up in something that black?
Russell asked quietly, glancing around to be sure no one was overhearing them. Navy Prime's officers' lounges were designed for this kind of conversation, though, with high-backed booths and strategically positioned white noise generators.
It was that or a desk,
Kyle Roberts explained cheerfully.
It won't be an easy op, Commander, he continued. I can't tell you much, but I can warn you that you won't be flying Falcons, and you'll be taking on an already existing wing.
Can you get me out of the PR grind?
Russell asked.
I checked in on that before I even called you, his old captain said with a chuckle. If you're in, we'll scoop you out of that in about 48 hours.
You should have led with that, the CAG replied. I'm in.
Exiting the lounge after breakfast, Kyle found himself immediately flanked by the two women in black, unmarked ship suits who'd accompanied him from the redoubt. While the Black Ops troopers were present for his security, he was sure they were also there to make sure he didn't break the confidentiality agreements he'd made.
Please tell me you two ate, he asked them as they headed to his next meeting. The lounge is familiar with bodyguards, the senior of the two women said calmly. They brought us breakfast.
Outside of Navy facilities, Kyle had a Marine protective detail. He didn't normally have Marine bodyguards inside Navy stations or aboard ship, but he would have changed that policy on his own even if Glass hadn't imposed the pair of black-clad Amazons on him. Getting stabbed wasn't something he wanted to get used to.
Good, he told the troopers. We still got a busy time ahead of us, and I wouldn't want either of the badass women they assigned to guard me deciding they need to eat a passerby for sustenance.
That got a smirk out of both of them, and a thorough double-take from a Navy lieutenant commander heading the opposite direction.
We're meeting Mason at the Deck 175 shuttle bay, he reminded them. Let's get moving.
Mason looked better than she had even a few days before, though part of that might be that Kyle hadn't just got himself stabbed before meeting up with her. She looked much more relaxed as they met over coffee at another officer's lounge.
Did you decide what you're doing with that package? Kyle asked her.
Not yet, she admitted. Knowing that he was thinking of that possibility, of us, it helps. I've had the samples stored groundside in a proper facility. They'll be there when I decide.
She smiled sadly.
It's almost as though he'll be there when I decide.
He wouldn't have wanted you to rush the decision, he told her. You know that.
I do,
Mason agreed. She glanced at the two bodyguards at the next table over.
I'm guessing that this isn't entirely a social call, what with the shadows and all.
I'd have Marines if I didn't have them after what happened the other day,
Kyle admitted. But yeah, I'm after more than a coffee.
What do you need? She asked.
I have a command, he told her quietly. It's all hush-hush, cloak-and-dagger crap, but I have a command. I need an XO, one I can trust. You were the first to come to mind.
Kelly Mason paused, silent in thought for a long moment.
I've only been on Sunset for 6 months, she said quietly. Leaving them in the lurch wouldn't feel right. I'm guessing this is volunteer only?
Yeah, Kyle admitted, racking his brain for arguments.
Then I don't, she said simply. I can't leave my ship in the lurch just because you ask, Kyle. Holding her together is my job, after all.
I hate to say any ship is more or less important than any other, he replied. But Sunset is a home fleet cruiser. We're
going back to the front. I can't say more than that, but this mission is a lot more important than holding down the fort here. Plus, he glanced over at the bodyguards. I'm only so sure I can trust even our intelligence people. I'm walking into a snake pit, Kelly, and I'm bringing half of the snakes with me. I need someone I can trust at my right hand.
She was shaking her head as he spoke.
I can't, Kyle. You're going to walk into the heart of the fire. It's what you do. You've walked out every time before, but I can't be sure you'll walk out this time. And, well,
she shrugged helplessly.
If I walk in there with you and don't walk out, then I never get to decide about Michael's child. The Navy will still send me to war sooner or later, she continued, and I'll go. But I'm not sticking my head into the fire next to you, Kyle. I'm sorry, but I'm not.
He sighed. Fair enough, I suppose, he allowed. It's not like we can order you to volunteer.
If you got JD personnel to sign off, they could order me to go. But I'm not volunteering. Anything else I can do to help, I will. But I'm not going with you, she said, her tone final.
Got a suggestion for a tactical officer? He said hopefully, mostly joking. His own list for that role was non-existent, but he was hoping Glass or Rondell would come up with someone.
I do, actually, she said after a moment's thought. Our ATO, Assistant Tactical Officer, is due for her second gold circle. She's the type that might be brilliant, but hasn't had a chance to show it yet. Even if she isn't, she's damn capable and looking for a role where she can earn herself some attention.
What's her name?
Jenny Taylor, Mason told him. She doesn't know it yet, but she's getting bumped to commander the moment we have another ship to put her on. She'll volunteer, and twice as fast if I tell her the Stellar Fox is in command.
I don't have a lot of options, Kyle admitted. Talk to her and let me know. Taking over one of the designated hotel offices left empty for officers passing through the Navy's HQ to use, Kyle waited impatiently while his escort checked that the communications linkage was clear of bugs and monitoring programs.
You're clean, she reported.
Thank you. He linked his implant into the setup and flipped a video channel onto the wall screen. One of Navy Prime's ubiquitous junior lieutenants popped up on the screen.
Navy Prime Off-Station Communications, please authenticate ID and state your request, she said calmly.
This is Captain Kyle Roberts, he told her while simultaneously flashing his ID code from his implant. I need access to a QCOM channel for a self-directed connection, please.
Understood, Captain Roberts. Connecting you in to the QCOM and switching you over.
The earnest young woman disappeared, replaced by an interface screen that Kyle was only partially familiar with. Fortunately, his implant had the instructions, and he followed those quickly as he input the code to connect him with Glass at the redoubt.
Captain Roberts, how are you making out?
The old man asked as he appeared on the viewscreen. Not bad, Kyle replied. Rokos has signed on as CAG. Mason wasn't interested, but she found us a tactical officer. I've got a few people I can reach out to fill the XO slot still, but I'm wondering if Rondell came up with anyone.
He did, Glass told him. The ATO from Rondell's last ship is just finishing up a round of medical leave. Maxim Chownik is the man's name. He was XO on Corona last. Barely made it off the battleship alive.
How's his mental? Kyle asked carefully. Corona had been Vice Admiral Tobin's flagship before Avalon, and Tobin had ended up on medical relief while flying his flag from Kyle's ship.
Not perfect, according to his shrink, the spy admitted, but he's itching to get back into action and volunteered. You'll meet him on the redoubt, unless you want to veto him.
Kyle considered his own list of potential execs, all of whom were already on warships somewhere. No, I'll take him, he decided. Anything else?
Just one thing, Glass told him.
Your Marine Company commander got tied up in paperwork and is still on Castle. It would save time if he can hitch a ride with you. You know him, Lieutenant Major Edvard Hansen. Hansen volunteered for this? Kyle asked. I'm going to owe the man a beer. He'd already sent Hansen into a few more hells than he liked, but the Marine was good at his job.
Toss him one on the shuttle flight. I want you back on the redoubt as soon as possible. I'll fill you in on details once you're back, but it looks like we're going to need to accelerate our launch.
Chapter 7. Castle System.
1600, April 28th, 2736, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. Chameleon, Gawain Orbit.
Wing Commander Russell Rokos regarded with scant favor the starfighters neatly stacked along Chameleon's flight deck. He'd been flying the Federation's new Falcon starfighter since their first major deployment aboard Avalon's predecessor ship. The Falcon was a seventh-generation starfighter and generally regarded as one of the best seventh-generation birds so far. The cataphract that the Stellar League had put into commission 15 years ago was not so well regarded. It was a 16-meter-long cylinder, 4.5 meters in diameter, with a lance along the spine and launchers that basically dropped missiles into space and let them fend for themselves. Its engines sucked, pulling 50 gravities less than a Falcon. Its electromagnetic deflectors sucked. Its positron lance sucked, barely 60% of the strength of the Falcon's weapon.
"I don't suppose we snuck any upgrades into these?" he asked plaintively, studying the ships.
"Some,"
his newest headache, Flight Commander Laura Cavendish, replied. The Black Ops squadron leader studied the starfighters without any more positive of an eye.
"Only what Intel said we could justify pirates having, though. Engines and mass manipulators got rated for modern third-tier acceleration, so closer to 500 Gs, not 450. Deflectors are tougher than we could honestly justify, stacked up to the Falcon's standard."
"Weapons?"
he asked hopefully.
"Same lance," she admitted. "Our targeting package, which helps more than you'd think. The launchers are a type you won't find on our birds, though. Better in a lot of ways."
"Oh?"
Russell asked. There wasn't much he'd expect the League to have done better than the Federation.
"Cycles slower, but the magazine and the launchers can take anything," Cavendish told him.
The dark-haired woman eyed the fighters with a cold smile. "The guys we got the sample from had them all intermixed in the magazines. The performance parameters are close, but if you've got one of our Starfires in one launcher and a League Sarissa in the other..." She chuckled. It wasn't a pleasant sound. "I don't recommend it."
"But they let us use whatever ammunition we can get our hands on and break the security codes on,"
Russell said. "That would come in handy."
"Exactly."
The wing commander studied his deck carefully. 32 of the starfighters were painted in the standard dark gray the Commonwealth used for all of their small craft. 8, however, had been coated in a shimmering black material.
"I'm guessing the black ships are yours?"
he asked Cavendish.
"Yeah,"
she confirmed. "The coating is radar absorbent, and we built cold gas thrusters into ours. They're not particularly stealthy, but it can give us a nice surprise every now and then." From Cavendish's comments, Russell suspected that the stolen pirate fighters weren't nearly as new to her pilots and crews as they were to his people. Just what had they been up to before they were assigned to Chameleon? Lieutenant Major Edvard Hansen didn't exactly mind flying. The lanky, dark-haired Marine spent the vast majority of his time aboard spaceships of one stripe or another, but somehow, shuttle flights were different. Assault landings and so forth were one thing, but a 12-hour flight trapped in a barely armored tin can left the Marine very aware of the emptiness of the void outside. He was ecstatic to finally reach Redoubt and board Chameleon. Actual ships had internal bulkheads, armored baffles, and emergency airlocks in the case of a breach. Shuttles didn't. By the time he carried his duffel into the barracks aboard Chameleon, hidden away in the extremely utilitarian portion of the ship not meant to be seen by inspectors, he was in a spectacularly foul mood.
"Who's the new guy?"
someone bellowed as he entered the central area and glanced around. The Commonwealth used much the same structure for the Marine bays as the Federation did, with a central mess hall come gym come gathering area with multiple wings of rooms heading off, one for each platoon's berths and one for the officers' quarters. The original bellower stood up, drawing attention to himself amidst the gathered collection of Marines. Edvard's practiced eye picked out the different collections of people, almost but not quite breaking down by platoon. One platoon had come from Avalon. They recognized him and were leaning back to watch the show. A second was the Intel Black Ops people,
their shipsuit uniform bases lacking the green piping of the rest of the men and women in the room. They might not have recognized Edvard, but they saw that Avalon's platoon had. The last platoon, according to his files, was a collection of squads cut free from various home fleet units, and he knew damned well they wouldn't have sent the best.
Well?
The big thug demanded, closing with him. Edvard realized his duffel was covering his rank insignia and made the instant decision to leave it there.
Who are you, new guy? A Marine? Or did somebody mess up and send us a stripper? You're too pretty to be a Marine.
And who are you? Edvard asked calmly. The other man had half a dozen centimeters on his own height and, unlike the officer, was not built like a beanpole.
I'm Sergeant Rothwell, the brick wall replied. A name you should remember, new guy. Nobody messes with Rothwell. Lesson you should learn fast.
Is it? The officer said slowly, glancing around the room.
And if I suggest that perhaps you should tone down your welcome to newcomers, Sergeant, what happens then?
That clearly hadn't been what Rothwell was expecting, and his face flashed white with anger. Edvard ran through his mental checklist and wondered how this bully had ever made Sergeant. He went to drop his duffel bag and end the game, but Rothwell was already moving. For a big guy, he was fast, but not fast enough. Before the sergeant managed to reach Edvard, however, there was a blur of motion. A petite young woman with short-cropped copper hair had been sitting at one of the tables next to where the confrontation had been taking place, and she was up and in Rothwell's way in a burst of impossible speed. The next thing anyone knew, Rothwell was on the ground, and the woman in the unmarked ship suit was saluting Edvard.
"Welcome aboard Chameleon, Lieutenant Major," she said crisply.
He didn't need his implants to identify her. While every Marine had a degree of chemical and cybernetic enhancement in addition to the neural implants every citizen and soldier had, only the heavily augmented Black Ops troopers could move that fast.
"Lieutenant Sandra Riley," he greeted the commander of his Black Ops platoon. "Thanks for the assist."
Giving her a nod, he stepped over to Sergeant Rothwell and slung his duffel onto the floor, unveiling his insignia at last.
"Caleb Rothwell," he said harshly, pulling the man's name from his implant files on the entire company. "Attend, hut!"
The big man struggled to his feet and saluted carefully.
"Sir, apologies, sir. Didn't recognize you."
"Striking an officer is a capital offense, regardless of whether or not you recognized him,"
Riley put in from behind Edvard, and he concealed a smile as the Black Ops officer dropped instantly into bad cop.
"That would require him to have actually reached me, Lieutenant Riley," Edvard pointed out. "Or to have struck me, which, frankly, I don't believe Mr. Rothwell would have managed in any case. I think we can skip the firing squad, don't you, Sergeant?"
"Sir, yes, sir,"
the non-com said desperately.
"Of course, you did attempt to strike me," Edvard continued calmly. "And your attempt at hazing would have been unacceptable regardless. Your stripes, please."
Rothwell swallowed hard and hesitated.
"Your stripes, Private First Class Rothwell," the company commander snapped.
Hesitation had just cost the man another rank, something he seemed to realize as he removed his sergeant's stripes and held them out to Edvard.
"Prove you gave me a bad first impression and you'll get these back by the time we're home," Edvard told him.
"Prove my first impression was right and I'll drum you out of the service. Are we understood, Mr. Rothwell?"
"Sir, yes, sir,"
the big man barked, but Edvard recognized the look in the man's eyes. He'd locked in his command of the company, but he couldn't expect the demoted Rothwell to forget how anytime soon. Chapter 8. Castle System. 1200, April 29th, 2736, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. Chameleon. The merchant ship component of Chameleon was fully functional in most ways, and though most of her actual working spaces were concealed outside that false front, the best conference room space aboard the ship was inside. Kyle stood at the center of the semicircular room, watching Lieutenant Major Edvard Hansen, the lanky commander of Chameleon's single company of Marines, chivvy the last straggler into the room before sealing the door.
With the exception of Glass, standing next to him at the podium, the men and women in the room were now under his command, and he knew far too few of them. Rokos sat at the back with his four Space Force flight commanders. A fifth flight commander sat with the rest of the Black Ops contingent near the front. Glass had assigned a platoon of ground forces and a squadron of starfighter crews from Intelligence's Special Forces teams to the mission. Kyle knew none of the Black Ops people, and they made him uncomfortable. Nonetheless, it was Glass's mission in many ways, so he'd let it stand. With Rokos and Hansen in command of the two groups, he was confident they couldn't cause too much trouble. His new executive officer sat in the middle at the front, looking like he was ready to spring into action, fight or flight reflex engaged. Chownik had apparently partially rejected regeneration treatments, and both of his legs and an arm were now artificial, but the surgeons had done a good job, and even knowing, Kyle couldn't tell. Next to the shaven-headed senior fleet commander sat newly promoted fleet commander Jennifer Taylor. Unlike Chownik, the woman with the shoulder-length blonde braid sat perfectly still, almost creepily so. His navigator and chief engineer had been selected by Rondell. Lieutenant Commander Tai Lao was an androgynous officer with dark skin and a pronounced epicanthic fold. Silver highlights on their forehead marked contact points for implants beyond the standard neural network. Lao's record noted them as a semi-augmented hermaphrodite, one of the Federation's pseudo-transhuman minority. His chief engineer was a small, sandy-haired man who seemed content to let everyone else do the talking. If Kyle hadn't known better, he'd have guessed the man as a non-entity, except that Kyle knew that Javad Ajam had been the lead engineer on converting Chameleon to Castle's service. "All right, people," Kyle declared, drawing everyone's attention to him. A scattering of junior officers around each of the seniors filled up the room, though he still only had about a third of Chameleon's officers present. "First, I want to thank all of you for volunteering for this operation," he told them. "None of you have more than the vaguest of what we're about, and you've signed on trusting the officers who asked you. We appreciate it. That said, Mr. Glass is about to brief you on the high level of Operation Blue Sunbeam," Kyle continued. "Once that briefing is complete, you will have one final opportunity to back out. Unfortunately, that will come with significant communication restrictions until the operation is complete. If there's anyone you want to talk to in the next 6 months without it going through sensors, I suggest you leave now." He was unsurprised when Nunn took him up on that and stepped back, gesturing for Glass to take over the briefing. The old spy stepped up to the podium and eyed the crowd.
"As I'm sure you've all realized, Chameleon is an unusual vessel," he said. "For those of you who don't recognize her, she's a Commonwealth-built, Blackbeard-class Q-ship, built on a Troubadour J freighter hull. The various iterations of the Troubadour design are common even in Alliance space, and are extremely common in Commonwealth space. This means she's a ship that can go deep into Terran space without being noticed," Glass continued. "She has a suite of civilian and paramilitary ID codes, though using any of them around Terran intelligence could potentially blow our cover. However, the Commonwealth does not realize we captured her. We have assets that have dug into this, and they believe she's still in pirate hands. We are not," he admitted, "entirely sure how she ended up in pirate hands, but no one knows we have her. We have a line on munitions and intelligence from a contact in the Stellar League," Glass noted. "Blue Sunbeam will take us into the League, from where we will strike into the heart of the Commonwealth, the core worlds that fuel their industry and military machine. I will explain more details as they become relevant," the spy concluded. "But the key objective of Operation Blue Sunbeam is to trigger a Commonwealth punitive expedition into the Stellar League. An expedition the League's new dictator will be forced to respond to. Our mission is nothing less than to force the Commonwealth into a two-front war."
Kyle's office aboard Chameleon was outside the false front and suffered noticeably for it. There was no decoration. The chairs were uncomfortable and the walls were plain metal. But the communications system and wall screens worked, so he could live with it. especially once his beer fridge was installed in the corner. He slid a beer across the desk to Glass and considered the spy for a long moment. If you're planning on dealing out the details in penny packets, I'm assuming you're planning on coming with us? He asked carefully. The concept of having each piece of the mission doled on a bit-by-bit basis wasn't appealing, but it was a covert mission.
I am, Glass confirmed. There's a lot of moving parts to this, and a lot of details are classified at the highest levels. I'm the only one who knows everything, and I don't plan on changing that. No offense, Captain, but I've been building this op and the contacts for it as a potential plan for 10 years. I need to see it go off.
We weren't at war 10 years ago, Kyle pointed out.
We knew it was coming, the spy countered. Everybody knew it was coming. The Commonwealth believes humanity must be reunified under Terran guidance. So long as that principle of their culture is unbroken, Terra will attack anyone who does not kneel.
And I don't think we've ever known how to kneel, the captain admitted. My understanding was that I would be in command.
You are,
Glass told him.
I run the op. You command Chameleon. I'm not qualified to command a capital ship.
Then I damn well better be in command, Kyle told the older man bluntly. When he'd commanded Avalon and Vice Admiral Tobin had taken them out as a one-ship battle group, there'd been problems.
You give the briefings and the objectives, but I decide how we carry them out, he continued.
We can't have a divided chain of command in combat, do you understand?
Completely, Captain, Glass agreed. I will keep you informed as it becomes necessary, but understand that much of the information that enabled this mission could get our agents in the Commonwealth identified and killed if the Terrans knew we had it. My obligation to them is to hold the data close to my chest. I trust you as much as I trust anyone, Captain, but I'm afraid you must allow me my paranoia.
Glass's tone made the words an order. He clearly intended to cooperate, but his way. All right, Mr. Glass, Kyle allowed. If nothing else, he'd confirmed that Hansen's Marines had all come from Avalon. If the spy went too far out of line, well, that gave him options. He raised the beer. To the Alliance, then, he toasted. And damnation to our enemies. Chapter 9. Under Alcubierre Drive, outside Castle System. 1500, April 30th, 2736, Earth Standard Meridian, date, time. Chameleon. It was a point of pride among many Navy officers that they didn't actually need the consoles and displays that made up a warship's bridge. The vast majority of their work took place in cyberspace via their neural implants and the ship's computers. The displays were an augmentation to that, handy to have, but not a necessity. Kyle and the bridge crew of Chameleon were getting to test that theory. The ship's Terran designers had considered the possibility of needing to fool borders, so the public areas of the ship were an exact clone of the Troubadour-type freighter she'd been built to resemble. This meant her bridge was very much a civilian one. One big display, not dozens of little ones. Seats enough for the Corps officers, but no space for the immediate department sections they'd have around them on a warship. Those department sections still existed, but Chameleon's design had relegated them to a support bridge in the hidden sections of the ship. In theory, they were just as linked into the network as they would be in their usual location, but only time would tell if there was a reduction in efficiency from it. Kyle personally suspected that the designers were correct when they said there was no change in communication time or efficiency from the technology side. He also suspected that they'd see a reduction in efficiency regardless, just from the teams not being able to see their officers' faces. Commander Lau, he said aloud to his new navigator. How are we bearing?
Running clean, sir, the officer replied quietly. 10 minutes to Alcubierre safe zone. Destination?
Good question, Kyle told them with a broad grin. Lau responded with the tiniest hint of a smile, but there was a sign of hope there. Let me ask Mr. Glass.
Opening a channel through his implant, he pinged the spy.
Glass.
We're 10 minutes from FTL, Kyle thought at the man. Is this the appropriate time to tell us where we're going, or do you still want to wait? Glass's chuckle came across the link clearly.
Our destination is the new Edmonton system, he replied. Though I'm sure it's irrelevant at the moment, we'll be dropping out in the outer system at McMurray's Trailing Trojans.
That's 160 light-years from here, Kyle noted. 10 days for them to accelerate up to their maximum 10 light-years per day pseudo-velocity, 10 days to decelerate, and 6 days at maximum speed. Long trip.
We have the supplies for it, don't we?
We do, Kyle admitted. Supplies weren't the main concern for a long trip. Zero-point cells would pump out energy forever, so far as humanity could tell, and the Alcubierre Stetson drive didn't require fuel, just power. Food, water, and air were the issues, and the recycling capabilities of a warship were disturbing in their efficiency. Chameleon had those same recyclers and was better stocked than most warships. It would be 90 days, almost 3 months, before they had to go to the recycled protein bars that inevitably reduced crew morale.
We'll set the course, he promised. I'm not sure a Federation starship has ever taken that long a voyage in a single jump.
Their course would take them through 30 light-years of space belonging to the Alliance of Free Stars, and then 110 light-years of the Commonwealth before entering the Stellar League.
Few ships have, Glass admitted. But there is more to this mission than meets the eye, Captain. Testing our strike distance, that's another, if small, part of it.
Dropping the mental channel, Kyle turned his attention back to Lau.
Set your course for the new Edmonton system, he ordered the lieutenant commander. Let me know if there are any problems.
Shouldn't be, Lau said quietly, their eyes glazing slightly as they dove back into their systems.
Running the calculations for a 1.5 quadrillion kilometer jump wasn't exactly straightforward, and Kyle left the navigator to it as they checked in on the gravity fields. Minutes ticked by as the Q-ship accelerated farther and farther from Castle and Gawain. Finally, Lau turned to check back in with Kyle.
Course for New Edmonton complete, they noted. We are outside all detectable gravitational interferences and prepared to warp space on your command.
Carry on at your discretion, Commander, Kyle ordered.
He was linked into the neural net and noted that Lau confirmed the readiness of the ship's Class 1 mass manipulators, the massive exotic matter devices that created the Alcubierre effect and made up half of the ship's cost, with engineering via implant instead of allowed.
Interior Stetson online, Lau announced softly.
The image of the world outside in Kyle's implant faded behind a strange glaze, an energy field taking form that would protect the ship from the terrific energies contained inside the Alcubierre bubble.
Exterior online. Singularities forming.
The navigator's voice was clipped and quiet, and Kyle was used to longer reports on the process, though Lau's certainly contained all of the information he required. A second haze appeared farther out from the ship, protecting the castle system from the immense force of the four singularities Chameleon's mass manipulators had forced into existence. They twisted his view of space, slowly warping space-time to create the bubble predicted so many years before. Then reality vanished. An almost instantaneous flicker before a computer-generated image dropped into its place. The view from a ship under Alcubierre Stetson Drive wasn't particularly useful, so the computers assessed what a human eye would theoretically see at their pseudo-velocity in the absence of relativistic distortion and put that on screen.
We are underway, running clean.
Thank you, Commander, Kyle told Lau, glancing around the bridge. You have the watch, Commander Lau. Let me know if we have any problems.
Rank hath its privileges. In the case where two significant others were both capital ship commanders in the Castle Federation Space Navy, those privileges included being able to co-opt a few of their respective ships' QCOM links to talk to each other. Everything Kyle or Captain Mira Salas said was encoded and fed into a subsection of the block of quantum-entangled particles at the heart of each ship's communications array.
a matching section in a station back in orbit of Castle changed simultaneously, and then the switchboard station's routing computers connected it to the particles linked to the other ship. The quantum entanglement communicators and their associated switchboard stations represented mankind's mastery of one of the great mysteries of the universe, and unlike many of its other uses, Kyle didn't regard using it to talk to Mira as an abuse of said mastery. "We're on our way," he told her. "I can't say much more than that, obviously, but everything is moving according to plan."
"Wish I could say the same," Mira replied. The elegantly tall black woman looked tired. "The reinforcements the Terrans have rushed in aren't enough to take on Seventh Fleet, but they are enough to keep us watching over our shoulders and making showy appearances to keep the locals happy. The Admiral has a plan, but, well, I'm pretty sure Walking Stick does too."
"And no plan survives contact with the enemy," Kyle agreed. "How's Camarone?" Camarone was the flagship of Seventh Fleet, and the battlecruiser his then executive officer had inherited when Miriam Allstairs had been promoted to command the fleet. Both of them had done a decent job of ignoring their attraction until she'd no longer been under his command. They'd made up for as much time as they could until the war dragged Kyle home and left Mira at the front.
"Solid," she said after a moment's thought. "Getting a bit worn, for reasons that, well, I can't really say."
There were probably no sensors listening in on their conversation, but that was because it was a safe assumption that two capital ship commanders could censor themselves. Given the nature of both of their missions, the conversation was still recorded and could be reviewed if there were questions later. Kyle was quite certain that Camarone, and the rest of Seventh Fleet for that matter, had been running around from system to system in the area they'd liberated from the Commonwealth, seeing off any intrusion before it became a real threat. It would be exhausting, emotionally draining work with no clear endpoint, and Mira could no more tell him that was what was going on than she could tell him which system Camarone was currently in. He hadn't even been able to tell her the name of his own ship. The gaps in her conversation were almost more noticeable than what they could talk about.
"Did you manage to see your son while you were in Castle?" Mira asked.
"This op came up so fast, I didn't even set foot on the planet, let alone see Lisa or Jake," he admitted. Jacob Kerensky was his son, not quite 12 years old, with his high school sweetheart, Lisa. Jacob had been an accident he had responded to in the worst way possible, and he hadn't spoken to either of them for the first 11 years of Jacob's life. For all that, the pair had lived with Kyle's mother and received the highest child support the Federation's military would let him pay. "His birthday's coming up in 6 weeks," he continued with a sigh. "I guess after the last 11, my absence won't be strange, but still would rather have made it."
"I look forward to meeting him someday," Mira told him with a smile. "I'm sure he'll understand, Kyle."
"He understands my being away in the military better than he understands why I was gone for so long before," Kyle admitted. A 12-year-old, after all, couldn't be expected to understand that he had one of the worst fathers in the Federation.
"Give it time," she replied.
"Lisa gets it," he said thankfully. "Don't know how she ever forgave me, but she seems to have."
"But Jake,
the only way to really fix that is to be there, and I can't do that until the war is over." Though he supposed, now that it was too late to impact his decision, that the ability to spend time with his son should have been a selling point to the desk job Kane had offered him. "This mission is going to be long," he admitted. "I don't know when I'll be back." "You need to be careful," he admonished Mira. "No fighting like me. No one should fight like me. Not after Hui Xing."
"Nobody in the Alliance thinks you messed up at Hui Xing except you, Kyle," Mira told him. "Everyone else is too busy being stunned at one of the largest POW rescues of the last couple centuries. The Terrans won't know what hit them once we're done with them."
Kyle returned her predatory grin. "No," he agreed. "They won't." Chapter 10. Deep Space. 0900, May 5th, 2736, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time.
Chameleon.
Russell Rokos had a headache, and approximately 60% of it was due to the normally cheerful young man sitting on the other side of his desk. Flight Commander Zhang Li, despite his name, had the darkest skin color Russell had ever seen on a human, with the epicanthic folded eyes of his Chinese family. So far in the week Russell had known him, the squadron leader's teeth were usually flashing startling white in a wide smile as he told some joke or another, or simply in a brilliant grin at the general absurdity and wonder of life. Right now, however, Lee's lips were pursed tightly enough to visibly pale as the younger officer considered his words carefully.
"Well?" Russell asked gruffly. "You asked to see me, Flight Commander, and you seem pissed, so perhaps you can tell me what's going on?"
"It's the Black Ops Squadron," Lee finally admitted. "They're," he sighed, "throwing their weight around? I'm not sure how to describe it, sir. One of them yanked two maintenance crews off one of my birds to have them refinish a scratch in their anti-radar coating. My pilot was standing right there," he noted. "They didn't quite threaten her when she objected, but they were pretty damn close to the line."
The wing commander sighed. He'd been afraid of that. The Black Ops Squadron had clearly been doing something on their own without having to interact with regular Space Force crews before being assigned to Chameleon. Whatever that something was, it led Russell to doubt the supposed lack of other Q-ships in the Federation's service.
"Anything else?" he asked carefully. "I can only drop so many bricks on them for that."
"It's a lot of little shit, sir," Lee snapped. "They're constantly harassing my people. Nothing significant, just joking and the like. I'm not sure my people are going to take it for much longer, and if someone takes a swing..."
"We'll have a much bigger problem," Russell confirmed. "What about the chiefs?" he asked.
His chief and senior chief petty officers should know better than to let this kind of crap continue. "They either grabbed the teams without a chief or lean on the couple who either worked with them before or are scared of them," the junior man replied. "It doesn't feel like they're being careful, but..."
"But these are the kind of guys who end up in Black Ops squadrons," the wing commander said flatly. "The next time you see something, Lee, ping me. Immediately. Understand?"
"Yes, sir." Technically, Lee was on par with Flight Commander Cavendish, but in practice, on an intelligence ship, the Black Ops Flight Commander was more equal than others. But no matter what she thought, she reported to Russell and was part of his wing. He might need to remind her of that. In the end, Lee didn't need to ping Russell at all. His own first squadron leader had insisted that all of the flight crews be thoroughly familiar with and review the maintenance of their starfighters. Russell had taken it a bit further than most, since he enjoyed occasionally getting his hands dirty by directly helping with the maintenance of his ship. That meant he was unidentifiable, head and shoulders inside the access panel to his cataphract's electronic warfare systems, rearranging blocks of molecular circuitry to see whether he could squeeze in another tower, when Cavendish loudly interrupted the team working on the starfighter next to his.
"Chief Peyton," she snapped loudly, "I need your team to check over my bird. I'm seeing a drift in the targeting radar alignment."
"We're in the middle of a diagnostic run on Flight Lieutenant Petrov's mass manipulators,"
Russell heard Chief Petty Officer Lyle Peyton object.
"I'm sorry, Chief. I thought I was giving you an order," Cavendish replied. "Shut it down and get to my bird now."
With a sigh, Russell dropped back out of his starfighter and ducked under the 9-meter-tall spacecraft.
"Commander Cavendish," he greeted her politely. "What is going on here?"
The woman looked at him in surprise.
"As soon as Peyton is done being insubordinate, he's going to be checking into my starfighter. Why?"
"Given that Flight Lieutenant Petrov's starfighter is on the maintenance schedule for Peyton's team for today, and yours is not, that was my question for you," Russell said mildly. "Does your starfighter have an antimatter leak? Has one of our zero-point cells somehow turned on in storage and the security of the ship is threatened?"
"No,"
Cavendish said slowly.
"Then you don't have an emergency worth disrupting the schedule that the chiefs carefully put together, Commander," he told her mildly. Carry on, Chief Peyton.
What in endless void are you smoking? Cavendish hissed. You want him to waste his time on one of your second-tier pilots' ships? My squadron has priority for repairs on this deck.
No, it doesn't, Russell replied. Certainly I didn't sign off on you having special priority.
We both know my squadron will bear the brunt of the real work, she told him. My people could run rings around any of the other squads.
He hadn't been planning on having this out in the middle of the flight deck, especially not with Chief Peyton and his maintenance team right there trying to be invisible.
Two of those squadrons have been in action with me since the beginning of the war, he said quietly. I've seen them fly. I've seen them fight. I trust them. I don't trust your people's skills, and your current attitude is aggravating that situation. This is my flight deck, Commander Cavendish, he reminded her. I signed off on the maintenance schedule. There is no special priority in it for anyone, and there never will be. Now apologize to Chief Peyton for your unjustified accusation of insubordination.
She stared at him for a long moment.
By the stars, you're serious, she snapped. Are you mad?
I am the commanding officer of this fighter wing, and you answer to me, Russell said, the control on his temper slipping slightly. You've interfered with Chief Peyton's work and falsely accused him.
I don't answer to you. I answer to Glass, Cavendish told him. And trust me, he will hear about this.
You answer to Glass? The wing commander ground out. That was not how the chain of command on this ship was supposed to work. And if it was, he wanted off. He knew damn well what Roberts would think of that theory. He held out his hand. Insignia, please, he said flatly.
What?
Glass is a civilian. If you answer to him, you are a civilian, and impersonating an officer is a criminal offense. Russell told her calmly, twisting his anger into a flicker of a righteous smile. You have two choices. Either you are Commander Cavendish, and you answer to me, or you are Miss Cavendish, and you are not flying a starfighter from my deck. Choose.
His hand was still outstretched, and her gaze focused on it. He was quite proud that there was no waver in his palm.
Now.
There was a long moment where he truly wasn't sure what the dark-haired woman in the unpiped uniform was going to do. Then she inhaled sharply and nodded.
Chief Peyton, I apologize for my hasty comments, she ground out slowly. I will make sure my request is added to the maintenance schedule for before we arrive in New Edmonton.
Was that so hard?
Russell asked, knowing it was probably too much of a twist as he said it.
Eternal stars, Rokos, you win, she snapped. I'll talk to my people. We'll respect your damn schedule. Just let it go.
Carry on, Commander Cavendish.
After the first week, Kyle had settled into a routine of having dinner each evening with Chownick and Taylor. Both were junior for their roles, and it let them bring up their concerns in a less formal setting than his office. Tonight was the second time Glass had joined them, and Kyle noted that the spy's presence put both of his junior officers on edge, though he would admit it could also be the food. As a matter of principle, he never ate anything different from what was being prepared in the regular officers' mess. This time they were trying for Tau Ceti cuisine, described as the result of a French father and Indian mother arguing over what to feed the children, and the cooks hadn't got it quite right.
My biggest concern remains our magazine levels, Taylor told him as they finally gave up on their meals, a mix of flavors that might have worked in different proportions, and Kyle gestured for the stewards to bring in dessert. We only have 3 missiles for each of the Javelin launchers, and a grand total of 6 for the capital ship launchers.
The pirates who stole her from the Terrans sold everything that wasn't nailed down, Glass admitted. We couldn't risk using missiles from our own stockpiles. Even a single dud could be traced back to having been in our possession by Commonwealth intelligence after the fact and undermine the entire operation.
I hope we have a plan for that, she asked, somewhat acidly.
Were Glass a superior officer, Kyle would have yanked her up short, but he was a civilian, and one that was playing his cards too close to his chest for Kyle's liking.
Of course we do,
Glass confirmed affably, proceeding to sip his wine rather than explaining further. Realizing more was expected of him, he shrugged.
We made sure that we had fighter munitions, and since those are League manufacture, the Terrans won't have the data to trace them back to us. They'll have far too good an idea of where exactly any Commonwealth weapons went missing.
A little more detail would be handy, Chownik murmured. It's hard for us to plan tactics and strategies in a vacuum.
Even under Alcubierre Drive, 20 light-years from anywhere, there is no guarantee that this ship is entirely secure, the spy said calmly. A spy could have hidden a QCOM relay aboard without it being detected.
This crew was double and triple checked, Kyle objected. You do them a disservice, Mr. Glass.
Perhaps, Glass allowed. But a secret held by one man cannot be spilled. Every person who knows the details increases the odds. Besides, he shrugged, it's not like your people are doing everything to inspire my confidence, Captain. I'm hearing a lot of complaints from my people on the flight deck.
Your people, Mr. Glass? Kyle said mildly. I wasn't aware you had any staff with you.
You know what I mean, Captain Roberts, Glass said flatly. The Black Ops people are mine, regardless of what you think, and they do not appreciate the way they are being handled.
Mr. Glass, who is in command of this ship?
What?
You are, the spy replied. I thought so, Kyle said. So why are you interfering? Regardless of the branch of the personnel under my command, they are under my command. The Black Ops squadron on my flight deck was interfering with the proper operation of the deck, and Commander Rokos handled the matter.
We are going to need those people at their best, Captain, Glass replied. Harassing them is not going to help.
Wing Commander Rokos has been far more patient with Cavendish and her people than I would have been, Kyle told him mildly. I'd have grounded at least one of them by now, assuming I hadn't thrown any of them in the brig.
They're Black Ops, Captain. They're worth some coddling.
I've flown with Commander Rokos, Kyle replied. I know what he and his people are worth. Cavendish and her team could be gods made flesh, and they wouldn't be able to outfly the squadrons we brought over from Avalon. Regardless, when you assign them to this ship, you place them under Rokos's and my command. They will follow our orders and operate under the rules of Rokos' deck, or they will not fly off that deck.
Kyle held up a hand before Glass could say anything more.
You told me I commanded this ship, he reminded the spy. So I will command her.
Very well, Glass said with a sigh, leaning back in his chair with his wine glass. I just hope your command doesn't cause us more problems than it might solve.
Chapter 11. Deep Space. 1900, May 20th, 2736, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. Chameleon. Chameleon hadn't been built by the Castle Federation, which meant it lacked many of the amenities a Federation warship would have included by default. The lack that Lieutenant Major Edvard Hansen felt the most keenly, however, was the atrium. Every Federation warship had at least a small artificial island of greenery buried somewhere near its heart. While the designers swore the greenery was an essential part of the life support system, the young Marine figured it was about two-thirds tradition and one-third the religious preferences of the crews. He wasn't entirely sure how the Reformation Wiccans aboard, like the captain and the new XO, were handling the lack of green space. While Christianity was firmly the second largest religion in the Federation, it kept trading the place of second largest on Castle with the Wiccans, which probably resulted in their desires having a disproportionate impact on the design of Castle warships. Edvard himself, though, was a member of the single largest religious grouping in the Federation, the largest in the Alliance of Free Stars and in the top four in the Commonwealth, as he understood, the Stellar Spiritualists. A disorganized, come-as-ye-are, leave-as-ye-will, half-secular awe at the universe
half-semi-agnostic worships of stars as divine path, the spiritualists nonetheless had been very successful spreading their word over the last 500 or 600 years. Like Wiccans, they preferred to worship in natural settings under the stars. In the absence of atriums or observation decks, however, they made do. Edvard wasn't sure who exactly had set up the spare storeroom near the marine barracks with the wall screen of the stars and the half-dozen potted plants as an approximation of the usual shrine, but he appreciated it nonetheless. His quiet was interrupted, however, when Lieutenant Sandra Riley threw the door open and looked down at him with a sigh of relief.
"Oh, thank the stars you're here," she told him. "First place I checked, too."
"Sorry for interrupting, sir," he replied dryly. "We have an emergency, sir. Any chance these sound like they should be familiar?"
"Sorry for interrupting. We have a fucking emergency," Riley snapped and tossed him a weapon.
He caught it instinctively, only then realizing she'd been carrying two weapons in her offhand. Years of practice had him checking the weapon, instantly identifying it as a military police electron laser stun gun. "What's going on?" he asked, suddenly serious and mildly afraid.
"One of my boys and two of yours have gone missing," Riley said harshly, gesturing for him to follow her.
Gunnery Sergeant Jonas Ramirez, Edvard's strong right hand since before he joined 7th Fleet and then followed Roberts to this sideshow, waited outside. The shadow-skinned, wiry man held a third stun gun, but he'd also slung an assault shotgun over his back.
"Who are we missing, Gunny?" he asked quickly.
"Rothwell and Carter," Ramirez replied instantly.
"Neither are from our last company. Carter's young and pretty, naive as fresh milk, too."
"Fuck.
Yours, Riley?"
"Ivan Connor," she said flatly. "Gambler, petty smuggler, the usual source of porn and harmless vice for my team. A perennial problem child, but never caught red-handed and never into real trouble."
"Familiar with the type," Edvard noted. "How missing are we talking?"
"They left the barracks together an hour ago," Ramirez explained. "Didn't say where they were going. Could be a card game, could be a tryst."
"But this ship's systems were set up by paranoids, and we didn't see a reason to change that," Riley said grimly. "Internal systems ping everyone's implants every 15 minutes. One missed ping doesn't flag anything. Two does."
"And why did I not get this alert?"
"Because Glass wouldn't trust his own mother to serve him milk and cookies," Riley said in an exasperated tone. "Of course, I don't have the authority to jack into the internal security sensors and sweep the cameras for them."
"I do," Edvard said grimly, already halfway through the process.
He never finished it. He was bringing up the artificial stupid demon he'd used to run the sweep when a message hit his personal comm code like a ton of bricks.
"It's Rothwell, Deck 6, Sector 12, son of a bitch fu—"
The message cut off in a squeal of jamming, but the recently demoted non-com had told Edvard everything he needed to know. Ramirez and Riley were only steps behind him as he took off running. Deck 6, Sector 12 was buried deep in the concealed warship components of Chameleon, a storage bay that would, eventually, contain the components that would allow her to manufacture replacement missiles, provided a supply of raw rock. Since Chameleon didn't have any of those components, the entire sector was currently empty. Corridors were on minimum lighting and doors were shut. Maintenance bots kept there from being enough dust to track anyone, but Edvard didn't need to resort to anything quite so traditional. The Castle Federation assumed that their marines would spend most of their battles wrapped in the heavy armor the Federation had built for them, but not all of their battles. Edvard had nowhere near the level of genetic or cybernetic augmentation that, say, Riley had, but he was even less vanilla human than a Navy officer. Most usefully right now, he could see thermal signatures without any additional gear, which meant that from this close, he knew exactly where their three lost sheep had ended up. All three appeared to be alive, too, which was better than he'd expected.
"That way,"
he silently sent to the other two over their implants while he gestured to the specific door.
"On three."
Three fingers folded down in sequence, and then he overrode the door and forced it open. Ramirez was through first, cutting in front of both officers before they could object. There was a blur of motion,
and the wiry NCO was skidding across the floor with no one knowing quite what had happened.
"Drop the weapon, Connor!"
Edvard barked, charging into the room after his non-com and registering the pistol in the soldier's hand. Years of training allowed him to process the scene in moments. Rothwell was slumped against the wall, maintaining pressure on a gut shot. The wound wouldn't kill him, not with the nanites running in any Federation citizen's system, but letting go of it would be a bad idea. Private First Class India Carter wasn't in much better shape. It didn't look like she'd been shot, but the way she was crumpled on the floor suggested that she'd broken at least one limb. She was looking at both of the men in the room with a death glare that Edvard was perfectly happy not to have directed at him. Connor had been in the middle of the room, quite probably threatening both of the Marines with the gun when the door opened, but had met Ramirez before the gunny was a full meter inside the door. The Black Ops trooper was still turning with the throw that had deflected the first Marine. But his gun was turning toward Edvard, and his training kicked into full gear as the threat fully registered. Time stayed in the strangely slowed state of adrenaline-fueled action, and he charged into Connor's arm, throwing his full weight against the cyborg's single arm. From the somewhat less redacted briefing Edvard had received on the Black Ops troopers assigned to his command, Connor's arm was as much metal as it was flesh and blood. 90 kilos of pissed Marine officer was more than even that could resist. The gun went flying, but Connor's other hand flashed around, driving for Edvard's throat. The cyborg was fast, but so was Edvard. He smacked aside the fist and then ducked under the half-wild haymaker the other man used to recover from the original impact. Edvard blocked a second strike and kicked out at Connor's leg, trying to bring the man down. Connor yanked his leg back just enough to avoid the blow, using the momentum to launch a series of strikes that pushed Edvard back. The lieutenant major had been fast and strong before the Marine physicians had their way with him, but he couldn't match the cyborg coming at him.
"Edvard, down!" Riley snapped.
He dropped. He saw a moment of realization flash into Connor's eyes as the Black Ops trooper realized just how badly he'd screwed up. Then the electron laser of a full-power stun gun flashed across the room like the wrath of an angry god. Thousands of volts transferred into the man's chest, and he exploded backward, flesh and circuitry alike flashing to vapor as the overcharged beam tore through him.
"Damn it, Connor," Riley said quietly. "You know these things only work on us at lethal."
Chapter 12. Deep Space. 2300, May 20th, 2736, Earth Standard Meridian, date, time. Chameleon.
"All right, Rothwell. What in endless void happened?" Edvard demanded.
With Carter in the infirmary and Connor in the morgue, the big ex-sergeant was his only chance of getting an explanation of just why one of Lieutenant Riley's men was now an electrocuted corpse. To be fair, Rothwell belonged in the infirmary, but he'd been patched up enough for this conversation, and unlike Carter, he could currently walk. Ramirez had dragged Rothwell into the office and was standing directly behind the Marine, somehow managing to loom despite being barely two-thirds the other man's height. Riley had taken over the only chair other than Edvard's in the room.
"It was supposed to be a poker game," Rothwell said with a sigh. "Connor was trying to play me. I was trying to play him. I brought Carter along to make him feel comfortable. She's not a bad poker player, but she was playing honestly, and we weren't."
"And this led to multiple broken limbs, a gut shot, and a dead man? How?" Edvard said sharply.
"Didn't realize until too late that Connor was after more than money out of Carter," the ex-sergeant admitted. "I let him run her out of cash to get him confident. I was planning on getting her most of it back in the process of cleaning Connor out. But then he talked her into putting, well, sleeping with him in the pot."
"Void," Riley whispered. "That shit."
"I may be an asshole, but I'm not 100% a dick. I wasn't having any of that," the Marine told them. "So I cheated the next hand in Carter's favor. I don't even think he caught me, but he was not accepting losing that hand."
"If he wanted in her pants that badly, he should have tried flowers," Edvard said grimly.
I take it things went poorly from there?
Connor pulled a gun. Carter kicked him in the nuts. I tried to separate them and got shot,
Rothwell said calmly.
That's when I pinged you.
What about the jamming? Edvard asked.
Gambling is against the articles,
the Marine said calmly.
So we had a small jammer covering us to keep our implants off the ship's net. I killed it to ping you, and then he triggered another one I couldn't see.
All right, Edvard allowed, glancing at Riley. Her expression suggested there was more she had to say, but not in front of Rothwell.
You understand that you fucked up royally, right?
He demanded of the Marine.
Figured that out about when Connor tried to rape the kid, yeah. I'm an asshole, but that's too far.
On the other hand, you called it in when you did realize that things had gone too far, Edvard allowed.
Are you prepared to accept administrative punishment, or do I need to bump this to Captain Roberts?
Rothwell straightened to attention, his eyes straight ahead.
Administrative punishment, sir,
he said crisply. Edvard glanced at Ramirez, who gave him the tiniest of nods, a sign to go at least a little easy.
Gunnery Sergeant Ramirez, note for the record that Private First Class Rothwell is restricted to quarters and company exercises for 1 week,
he said calmly.
Also note that Private Rothwell is docked 1 month's pay. No disciplinary note is to be made to Private Rothwell's file, he finished.
The five ranks he'd slashed the man for attempting assault on an officer would be enough of a black mark on the man's career.
Do you understand your punishment, Private Rothwell?
I do, sir,
the big Marine confirmed. He still looked pissed at Edvard, but at least he seemed to know where the line lay.
Gunny Ramirez, escort Private Rothwell back to the infirmary, please.
Once the door slid shut on the gunny and his prisoner, Riley made a loud sound of disgust.
One of my men dead, and not even because we have a spy or a traitor, she snarled. Just because the idiot was a throwback who somehow thought he could get away with blackmailing and threatening someone into sex. Endless star-swallowing void!
This is going to be a problem, Edvard told her. Your platoon is already getting on the nerves of the rest of the company. Once word of this spreads, we're going to have fights. And your people are immune to stunners?
They are, she confirmed. And since you'd figure it out pretty quickly anyway after Connor's stunt, we also have internal short-range jammers. Any of my people who want to go dark on the ship's systems can,